Welcome to the Palace Perspective, brought to you by Palace Capital Advisors, a wealth management firm specializing in custom estate, financial, and tax solutions that others often miss.
Welcome back to the Palace Perspective, a podcast that brings you interesting topics about your financial lives. I'm your host, James Landry, and I'm joined here today by Rich Mullen, CEO of Palace Capital Advisors and one of the managing partners. Rich, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, James. Looking forward to our conversation today.
That's right. Me too. And today we're going to talk about concentrated stock, understanding the options, no pun intended, that an investor might have when he or she holds on to a concentrated stock position. Now, Rich, we regularly sit down on meetings where the central topic revolves around what a client needs to do or be thinking about with a concentrated position. And invariably, the client understands the risks inherent with a single security, low basis concentrated position. But for any number of reasons, they're reluctant or find it difficult to do anything about it. What would some of those reasons commonly be?
James, sometimes people are emotionally attached to the underlying security if they especially played a role in building the company or have been there for quite a while. There's some underlying allegiance. Also, fear of missing out on potential gains. They think the company may grow to the proverbial tree growing to heaven type of thing. So they hang in there perhaps too long. And then just resistance to selling because of tax implications. That's always a big one, right? That's some of the things we're going to talk about here today. And then, of course, there's corporate executives that are held to stringent selling standards, navigating legal constraints, especially high-ranking individuals. So they have to wrestle with blackout periods and windows ahead of earnings and things like that.
Yeah, so really any number of reasons why, and sometimes it's multiple reasons why an investor is reluctant to take action. And they may have accumulated the stock, like you said, they may have inherited it. And maybe they exercise a stock option of, you know, with their company and they have this stock, or like you said, the executive, many cases, executives, the stock in the company comprises a very large part of their overall net worth. So it's a real issue. And so today what we're going to do, folks, with your time is we're going to go through several of the strategies that an investor might consider to deal with a concentrated position. And so Rich and I are going to take turns talking about those strategies. And of course, we always hedge this, again, no pun intended, with the comment that not all these strategies are appropriate for every individual. As a matter of fact, many of them will not be, but it's important for that individual to seek out the advice of his or own investment advisor, tax advisor, and make sure that they know the best strategy for their particular situation. So let's get right into it, Rich. The first thing that people do is, what would you say?
Well, they can do nothing.
Well, that's,
you know, I think that's what we find a lot of times. I mean, let me just start, you know, back up just a second and say that we have deep experience here at Palace in dealing with concentrated equity positions. And there, to your point, there are a whole host of potential solutions or strategies that can be deployed. And we're going to touch on a bunch of them today at a high level. But yeah, the first one, of course, is basically kicking the can down the road and doing nothing.
Right.
And that can present all the problems we just talked about, you know, so. You know, the fear of losing out on capital appreciation can turn into a capital loss. So you have the idiosyncratic risk that's associated with holding an individual equity position. So typically doing nothing is not the best of alternatives.
Typically, you're right. But sometimes it actually can be the first thing you think about. And think about this scenario. If you have an older investor who doesn't feel like he or she has a lot of years left, and remember, under current law, if you die owning a stock, the basis in that position gets adjusted to the fair market value at the date of death. And so the strategy of doing nothing may be waiting around to get a quote unquote step up in cost basis. Again, that strategy, you have to weigh against that opportunity against the risk of holding on what could be a volatile stock in that position. And what goes up can also go right back down.
Yeah.
The second strategy that we'll talk about today is really, you know, instead of doing nothing, what about selling the shares, but not necessarily selling them all at once, putting a little bit of strategy behind it, strategically selling the shares. What does that mean, or what does that look like?
Yeah, it's a good question, James. So strategically selling shares obviously can take a couple of different routes or approaches. One is to just use losses somewhere resident in other parts of your life and matching them with the capital gains that would be produced by selling off individual shares. Another strategy that we've seen deployed effectively is selling calls. And calls and puts are types of options.
Okay.
And when you sell an option, you're selling away the right to do something. And when you buy an option, you're buying the right to do it. So in this particular case, you're selling a call and you're giving somebody the option to call the stock away at a specific price. So when you do that, you can just wait for that price to be hit. And the example that we often see is if the stock's trading at 100, you sell a 110 call, $110 call. So you're capturing some upside appreciation, and you can also capture some of the premium that you got when you sold it. So when you sell something, you get money back, right? So that's a strategy to kind of strategically sell. But there are other different ways you can do that, where you can take the option, sell the option, and then if you're afraid that it's going to get called away, say the stock starts to run up towards the strike price, buy the option back. In that particular scenario, the option would be settled at a loss. That loss can then be used to sell some of the shares, perhaps at a different time. So you can kind of stagger, you know, the approach a little bit, or work on a timeline that fits best for your needs.
Okay, so that's great. And you just kind of walked right into, I think, the next strategy that I was going to discuss, which was hedging the position. You mentioned, you know, writing covered calls or writing or selling a call option on the stock, the concentrated position. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, the use of puts, but also the use of callers here. And of course, we want to, before we get into the discussion, remind folks that in many cases for executives or certainly employees of a publicly traded company, their company is not going to allow them to hedge stock using puts and calls. In many cases, it's against company policy. But in the few chances that it does, a few opportunities that it does, these are things that an investor would consider, or someone that's not really tied into a company, just has a concentrated position. So what about puts and callers in that?
So again, going back to my example of selling or buying, in this particular case, you could use a put. And a put gives you the right, if you buy it, to put the stock to somebody at a specific price.
Okay.
And if you think about that, my example where the stock was trading at $100, you buy a 110 put or a 105 put or an at-the-money put, and that has a certain amount of time period attached to that option. And during that period, you have the right to put that stock to somebody at that price. So if you think about it, if the stock's trading at 100 and it suddenly drops to 80, you're locked in at the price that you sold the put at. So you can redeem the value of the stock.
So I've got a floor.
You have a floor.
Okay.
Exactly.
Great.
The other is going back to a combination of selling calls like we talked about and using puts. Mm-hmm. That's a collar. And what you do in a collar is you buy the put and then simultaneously sell a call. So you think about the stock trading at 100. You may buy a put at the money and then sell a call a little bit further out of the money. You use the money that you take in from the call to pay for the put or to offset the put. It depends on how you stagger the strikes of both of those options as to whether it'll be as what we call a zero cost collar, is when you can collect premium sufficient enough to actually offset the actual cost of the purchasing of the put. It doesn't always work out that way, but you can construct that collar again with some sort of guidance of what your desired timeline is and what you think the underlying behavior of the stock would be.
So thinking of strategies in combination then, Rich, for an investor who really took the first strategy, which is do nothing, he might or she might want to add in a collar along with that do nothing strategy that says, hey, look, if I'm just going to hold on to the stock until I'm no longer with the rest of planet Earth and getting a step up in cost basis, then I can protect it, the downside, by putting in that floor, that put, by buying that put.
That's right.
And I can offset the cost of that put by selling a call.
That's right.
I have to recognize that if I sell a call, I'm really limiting an upside for my position on that stock, right? Because it will get called away potentially.
That's correct. That's a good point. So another consideration here, in addition to whether or not you are encumbered by the restrictions that are placed on executives, we talk about windows and this ability to transact in your underlying stock. If those conditions aside aren't limiting you, you're not locked in when you sell a call or buy a put. If the underlying position starts to approach that call price and for whatever reason you now want to adjust it because you think it can go higher, you can buy that call back,
okay,
and avoid it being called away and then ratchet up the price as the stock appreciates. Keep in mind, if that scenario unfolds, you probably are looking at buying it back at a loss, but you can accumulate those losses and you can use them to offset some strategic selling of the stock at a future date.
I think a takeaway from here, Rich, is that the investor better know what they're doing when it comes to trading with options, or their financial advisor had better know what he or she is doing.
That's right. Right?
And working with the right individual is really critical. Let's move on, if we can, now to another topic, which is what I'll call monetizing a position. Monetizing a position is taking that concentrated position and finding some way to turn it into cash flow for me as an investor. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that would be?
Sure. There's a bunch of different ways to do it, but you could use the stock as collateral. Okay. And you could borrow against the position and use those proceeds to diversify. So you borrow a certain percentage of the underlying value and take that money then and buy a basket of diversified equities or bonds or what have you, some sort of a diversifying asset.
Through margin or through a securities backed line
right.
of credit.
Yeah, okay. good point. So we see typically two ways that this is done. Straight margin, which we think tends to be subject you to some more of the volatility of the market. We use what's called securities-backed lending, which allows for a little bit of a higher release, and there's a little bit more ability to adapt to the underlying volatility of the market. And that is probably a more preferred way if you're going to take this approach. Keep in mind, though, that by borrowing against a concentrated position and buying equities, you are increasing your volatility, right? And typically, though, with the securities-backed line of credit, they don't permit you to do that.
That's right.
You can only do that with margin.
Right.
Okay. But you could have the net effect of exacerbating your volatility. But if you're not willing to sell the underlying security or you want to hang on to it, you can use it as collateral, say, to buy a house or some other non-equity type asset.
And it's important to, you know, of course, just acknowledge that if you're borrowing to invest or borrowing really for any reason, you are increasing risk, right? So if the markets collapse, that stock position goes down, what's going to happen to that loan? Well, it's going to most likely get called at some point. And so the investor just needs to recognize that and go in with both eyes open
in
that.
That's right. But again, the securities-backed loans are not to be used to buy additional equities. It would only be margin in that particular case. So
there's another lesser known or really lesser used way to monetize, and that would be through the use of what they call a prepaid variable forward contract. And don't see a whole lot of those today, Rich, but perhaps you could tell us, you know, briefly what those look like.
Sure. They're very popular back in the tech days, you know, the early, the advent of the, right before the tech run, you know, when there was a lot of publicly traded tech companies coming out. A prepaid variable forward is an agreement to settle or sell the stock at a certain date or time in the future. And what the underlying firm would do, in this case, you'd do this transaction with us, through us or at a bank, is they would basically create the collar on the stock. And they would then use that to provide collateral to give you money or proceeds that you then could.
Could be up to 80% of the value of the stock.
It could be up to 80%. Yeah. You then could use those proceeds to go and diversify or buy a piece of real estate or what have you. At the settlement date, you have to make a decision. So the prepaid forward has a term that's associated with it. And at the settlement date, you have to make a decision as to whether or not you are going to settle it in the stock, meaning just let the stock go and it's an effective sale, or you can settle in cash. Okay. So you could choose, you know, for whatever period during that time, you decided you wanted to hang on to the stock because you thought there was some more upside. Then you have the ability to settle in cash. If you settle in stock, your tax is going to be the difference between the money that you received for the prepaid variable forward and the current stock at settlement. If you settle in cash, then you're just going to pay the cash. You've postponed the actual realization.
No gain recognition.
That's right.
Yeah. And you have to be careful with any type of derivatives contract. When you modify a derivatives contract, you best be careful because you can trigger a gain unwittingly by modifying a derivatives contract. And you know, when you trigger a gain and you weren't expecting to do that, then you're just going to be writing a check.
You know, that's a great point, James. Going back to the collar that we were discussing, collar strategy, one of the things that you have to be careful of is creating a collar where you've actually locked in the price and it can't fluctuate. You can run afoul of causing what's called a constructive sale. In the IRS's eyes, you have effectively sold that stock because there's no ability for there to be appreciation or depreciation. So you have to keep that collar wide enough so that there is some risk on the table.
And my understanding is the IRS is a little concerned about the abuse of prepaid variable forward contracts. So I think for that reason, they've maybe fallen out of a little vogue over the past several years. But let's move on, shall we? So we've talked about many things. Well, what's the next topic that we want to bring up?
I think one of the other more popular ones back in that day, and now I think regaining some popularity, is the use of an exchange fund.
Okay.
So an exchange fund is really an LP pool. And what it is effectively is a bunch of folks that are in your same predicament that have concentrated equity positions, and they all contribute them to a limited pool.
A partnership.
It's a partnership. Yep. Thank you.
Vehicle. Mm-hmm.
And the way the partnership's constructed is 20% of it has to be in a liquid stock. I mean, in a liquid investment. So typically
they'll take real estate.
Yeah. And they'll anchor the fund in 20% in real estate. Mm-hmm. Then what happens is, provided that the fund needs more or will accept your particular stock, because it could be a case where they've already accumulated enough of your underlying holding,
right?
Then you contribute the holding that you have to that fund. Then what happens is a timeline starts. If you hold that particular fund or that exchange fund, your position in it, for 7 years, then at the end of 7 years, you receive back a pro rata allocation of the underlying stocks that
still with your original basis.
With your original basis.
But now diversified.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. Yeah. So that's an important distinction. If you decide to take it out within 7 years, you're back where you started.
Yeah,
you get the stock and the original cost basis.
And we should say the exchange funds, and again, not to be confused with an exchange traded fund, totally separate instrument, but an exchange fund can be expensive. I mean, because typically you're paying for a manager that's going to deal with this partnership vehicle and deal with the tax accounting associated with that. So
that's right.
I would say inexpensive,
but an effective diversification tool.
That's right. We see those. Back in the day, one of the biggest players was an Eaton Vance. Used to do those quite a bit.
Yeah. And there are a lot of different variations on it. I believe Fidelity has one now. Yeah. In fact, I know they do. So there are some options there, but not a whole bunch, but there's certainly some options.
What about for corporate executives?
Yeah. So corporate executives, we go back to the original comment about the whole host of restrictions that they could be subjected to. There's always worries about optics. There's always worries about some of the concerns that we laid out in the front of this conversation, but insider trading, for instance. And
because for a corporate executive, Rich, I mean, almost invariably what he or she trades in the company stock will be public information.
That's
very
correct.
Soon, right?
That's
after.
Right.
So they're very much concerned about optics.
That's right.
Yeah.
Especially if they're insiders, deemed as insiders or Section 16.
Which they mostly
most likely would be. There's obviously Rule 144 that they have to abide by. But there are a bunch of different options available to them, James. And one of them maybe is the 10b5-1 plan. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the 10b5-1 plan has been around for a long time. And this is just a plan that an executive can put in place to help reduce the appearance of trading based on insider information. So it's a plan that he or she will put in place that says, hey, look, based on an algorithm or based on a certain price in the future or based on a certain event or based on someone making a decision outside of my control, the stock will be traded. And so the idea being that if the stock is traded, it's public knowledge. A regulator can't go back and say, well, you did that based on insider information. No, this plan was set up long before that insider information really would have been applicable. So it's not a, complete 100% foolproof against insider trading, but it is a defense and a regulator recognized defense against insider trading. Like I said, a predetermined value can be based on a formula, a timing of events, or someone can place the trades where it's really not underneath the executive's control.
A blind trust.
Yeah, in that way.
And it has to be open, of course, during like a window, as you said.
That's right. And there are all kinds of rules around when you can put in a 10b5-1, like you said, during an open window period. But also, if you want to modify the 10b5-1, you need to be very careful that you don't trip a rule around that, because then again, all your defense against insider trading well, I'll go away if you don't follow the rules.
Yeah.
For non-executives, or really just really any employee of a publicly traded company that has a 401k or retirement plan, many times you'll see, particularly if there's a company match type of thing, you'll see those retirement plans laden with the company stock. And so what's the strategy there that you think of?
I'm going to let you talk about it, but it's called net unrealized appreciation.
Yeah, NUA or NUA. Or NUA, yeah,
very
net unrealized.
Popular, by the way.
That's right.
Yeah, a lot of folks take advantage of it.
It is, you know, it's been around for a long time. It's one of those that, you know, many advisors forget to talk to their clients about. But if I have a 401k and I have a bunch of company stock in there and I'm going to retire from the company or depart from the company, and I want to talk about ways to efficiently take that stock out of my 401k, I might consider net unrealized appreciation. And when I have stock inside of a 401k, then it has a basis. The basis is basically, what did I pay for that stock inside the 401k? The basis may be relatively low relative to the value of the share of the stock inside the 401k. When I leave the company, if I'm willing to take out my 401k as a lump sum, I can take that basis out and put that into a non-qualified or a taxable account of that stock. And only the basis will be taxed on that stock as ordinary income. The difference between the stock basis and the actual value is what is called net unrealized appreciation, or NUA. And the net unrealized appreciation is not taxed as ordinary income. Rather, it's taxed as a long-term capital gain, but only at the point where I later then sell the net unrealized appreciation, okay? And it's always taxed as a long-term capital gain, no matter how long I hold it, 3 months or a year, 13 years, doesn't matter. And it also avoids, if I took the gain out before I was 59 and a half, it avoids a premature distribution penalty tax. So really a real cost-efficient way to take out my company stock from a 401k plan and pay tax on a really efficient manner. Now, it's not for everyone. If you notice, I took down that net unrealized appreciation, only paid income on the basis. All that NUA is going to be capital gain. And if I want to hold that on for a long time, oh, there's the got you. I have now a concentrated position. And we're back to where we began with, is I have a single security risk here. And so I have to weigh the tax advantage of NUA versus the risk of holding on to a concentrated position. So not for everyone. If I'm more concerned about a diversified portfolio, I can't sleep at night, then maybe the traditional 401k to an IRA rollover is for me, where I can just do the whole thing tax deferred as a rollover, pay ordinary income tax when I start taking money out of an IRA, but I can diversify while it's still inside the IRA.
Yeah,
right.
Fairly easily.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely right. James, what about, let's not forget the option for charity. You know, that's another way to kind of mitigate some tax implications associated with concentrated positions.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because for many clients, they have significant philanthropic intent, right? And if they do have the goal of benefiting charity to a significant extent, that strategy can be used in combination to provide them an income tax deduction, can help them avoid altogether the capital gain on diversifying the stock, if they're willing to use charity, and also can provide them a cash flow if they want to use a commonly used instrument called a charitable trust. And we'll go into those. Let's start with the basics. If I have a single security low basis position and I want to give to charity, I can write a check for cash and give it to charity, or I can turn around and give the stock to charity. If I give the stock to charity and the charity sells the stock or diversifies the position, my tax liability is zero. As a matter of fact, I got an income tax deduction for that gift. There are all kinds of rules, Rich, around how much of an income tax deduction I can take. And basically, it's limited to what they call a percentage of my adjusted gross income. That percent, if I give cash, is higher than if I give an appreciated security. But still, if I give an appreciated security and I fall within the limits of taking out full deduction, I can avoid the entire capital gains when the charity sells the stock. And many times when we talk about charity, you know, for many folks, it's their church or it's their synagogue, right? But in many cases, it could be a private foundation. But by the vast majority of cases, Rich, we see here in our own clientele, it's the use of a donor advised fund, right? Where I give a stock to a donor advised fund, I get an immediate upfront tax deduction in the year I make the gift. The donor advised fund can diversify that stock, continue to manage it. And then in future years, I can tell the donor advised fund, hey, it's time to make a distribution to the, you know, Boys and Girls Foundation of, you know, whatever. So really, really flexible instrument when it comes to single security, low basis position. Again, yeah, go ahead. You're going to say.
I was going to say. Yeah. Well, I finished that point, but then I was going to go, there's also that charitable strategy where you can kind of, you know, proverbial kill two birds with one stone or benefit mm-hmm. your family mm-hmm. or, you know, a loved one, yeah. but also be charitable and also yeah. take advantage of the diversification.
Yeah. You can have your cake and eat it too.
That's the expression.
That's right. So, and that's where you get into the use, a more advanced strategy of what they call charitable remainder trusts. A charitable remainder trust is a tax exempt entity. Okay. And so when and that trust is set up for the ultimate benefit of a charity, could be my foundation, could be a public foundation, could be a donor advised fund, could be a charity that, you know, is in my community. Okay. But it's ultimately for a charity. That ultimate benefit for a charity is at the end, but in between that trust, when I make a gift of cash or I make a gift of that low basis single security position, that trust can diversify that position and will take the diversified proceeds and can make payments back to me as the donor or to a family member for a term of years or for the rest of my lifetime as a donor, depending on how old I am. And in addition to that, Rich, I got an income tax deduction when I made the gift in the year that I made it to that charitable remainder trust. Now, there are all kinds of, you know, fine print and rules that you have to follow with this, as you might expect, but the charitable remainder trust is part of the Internal Revenue Code. So this is nothing terribly exotic. It's out there, it's codified, and we see, you know, our clients using this strategy all the time to benefit themselves from a cash flow need, to benefit charity, certainly, but also to get that income tax deduction, and then ultimately to diversify out of that concentrated position.
What happens at the end of the term?
Yeah, so at the end of the term, whether, again, like I said, whether it's a term of years or it's the end of my lifetime, or maybe if I'm married, if it's the end of our joint lifetimes, whatever's in that charitable remainder trust will go down to the charitable beneficiary, and it's whoever I designated. As a matter of fact, during that term, I can change the charitable beneficiary. So for example, year one, I set it up to be the donor advised fund or the Boys and Girls Club or the YMCA or whoever it is. I can change my mind in year two and year three if the trust is written in such a way to permit me to do
and
that.
And not so, disrupt all the other benefits.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right.
That's great.
Yeah, so very flexible.
What about the variation, the charitable lead trust? How different is that from the charitable remainder?
It's completely different. And it is a charitable trust, but it is not a tax-exempt entity like the charitable remainder trust is. The charitable lead trust, Rich, think about it this way, is more of an estate transfer vehicle. It's a wealth transfer vehicle to my family. It's sort of the charitable remainder trust turned upside down on its head, in that the ultimate remainder beneficiary of a charitable lead trust is not charity. It's typically the second generation or the third generation. Charity stands in the middle, though, and receives payments all along the way. Right. So it's not to be equated with a charitable remainder trust from that standpoint, but there are some similarities, but certainly some big differences.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, of course, we talk about setting up a private foundation,
yeah.
you know, but, you know, there's a lot of complications and a lot of considerations that are associated with that. Talk about that for a little bit.
Not the least of which is expense, right? Yeah. And usually when you're thinking about a private foundation, that becomes appropriate when an individual is talking about wealth in the, you know, $2 million and up in magnitude. I got a low basis concentrated position. Private foundation may be appropriate. But again, I would look to the donor advised fund as the first step before I would consider a private foundation, because it checks off almost all the boxes of a private foundation in terms of ultimate objectives, the income tax advantages. As a matter of fact, the income tax advantages for a donor advised fund can be superior mm-hmm. than those found in a private foundation. The private foundation, where it trumps the donor advised fund, is that it provides the family members the opportunity to be actively engaged and also be compensated, if done appropriately, for their, you know, involvement in the charitable endeavor through the foundation.
But they can also do that with the donor advised fund, but they can't be compensated.
They can't be compensated.
Yeah.
Right. But they can be involved. That's
they
right.
They can play a role in the family philanthropy. Yeah. We see families set that up all the time. They'll have a family meeting and You know, the children will be involved in bringing forward some sort of a charity that they've identified that they're interested in supporting, and that, you know, tends to kind of bring philanthropy home, I think, and really drive home, you know, a lot of that.
And you know, even with the foundation, I say you can compensate families. You have to, again, be very careful about that, because the IRS is keenly interested in these sort of self-serving arrangements, you know, that they'll come in and collapse and, you know, penalize you for. So the taxpayer just needs to go in again with both eyes open, get a lot of good advice. And I think that's really where we've come full circle, which is we started at the beginning of this saying there are a lot of different choices for an investor with a low basis, single security, concentrated position. The best choice that investor can make is a pick of the phone, talk to an advisor, get some advice that's unique to their situation, and that will be most helpful. And so that's what we would encourage, you know, listeners to do, is if you're in this situation where you got a low basis concentrated position, where you just feel like, you know what, I can't do anything because it's the taxes or it's emotional attachment or whatever the reason is, anything in between, pick up the phone, call your advisor, and let's talk about some of the options that might be available to you and what might be best suited for your particular situation.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about a lot of different strategies here. As I started out to say, you know, we here at Palace are experts in concentrated position and offer a lot of alternatives that are usually arrived upon through a discussion of what the desires are, what the risk appetite is. I mean, we've not talked about several others. You know, one of the more popular strategies right now is the use of direct indexing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And, you know, there are certain variations of direct indexing that we deploy that will facilitate a similar ability to diversify a concentrated position, but do it in a manner in some instances where the tax can be partially or completely offset in the sale of that. That's a particular strategy that we deploy here. There's also things like basis hedging, where you have a concentrated position, you could find something that's closely correlated and you can do some hedging around that correlated security set. So there's a lot of different options, but suffice to say, it really all starts with a conversation.
That's right. And, you know, if folks want to get in touch with us at Palace, you can reach us at our website, palacecapitaladvisors.com. That's P-A-L-L-A-S, capitaladvisors.com. And we would welcome the opportunity to speak with you about your situation. Rich, I want to thank you for spending the time with me today. Really, your comments and insights really helpful, and go a long ways to
helping our clients. I mean, we covered, this is a very broad topic, and we tried to, you know, skim along the treetops here, but suffice to say, as you said, we're happy to sit down and talk about a lot of these different strategies. And some of them are new on the scene and really compelling, and love to understand everybody's situation before we make any sort of recommendations.
Absolutely. Well, listener, thanks so much for joining us today. Please join us next time at the Palace Perspectives podcast. We'll see you there.
The preceding information is for general educational purposes only. It's not intended to be investment advice and is not specific to any individual's personal situation. Any decision about investing should be undertaken only after careful consideration of the investment's risks, costs, liquidity, or lack thereof, and the investor's time frame. Please remember that past performance may not be indicative of future results. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk, and there can be no assurance that the future performance of any specific investment, investment strategy, or product referred to directly or indirectly in this newsletter or podcast will be profitable or equal any corresponding indicated historical performance levels. The investment advice is offered through Palace Capital Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor.